Good morning, everybody. It's 9 o'clock here in West Michigan on Eastern Standard Time, so we want to get rolling this morning with our adult Sunday school class from Grace Life Bible Church. My name is Pastor Brian Ross. I'm the pastor of Grace Life Bible Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And during our adult Sunday school hour for the past number of years, we've been doing a very extensive study on issues related to the inspiration, preservation, transmission, and translation of God's Word, with a particular focus on the justification for believing that for the English-speaking world, the Bible resides in the King James Version. And it's been a real honor and privilege to really get into the meat of this, and we're still in that, and we will be for some time. So if you're looking for a short treatment of that or a nutshell, you've come to the wrong spot. We're looking for really understanding in depth what happened with the Bible, how it was inspired, how it was preserved, how it was transmitted through time, and then ultimately the translation process that leads to the King James Bible in English. So we're in the middle of that, and we're going to be looking this morning at Lesson 117. Lesson 117. Now, I've shared, if you're on YouTube, which you are if you're with me right now, in the comments under the video, I've shared a link to the notes, and then I also shared a link in the top of the chat, of the live chat. So if you're going to be following along with me, you're going to want to be opening those notes. The other place that you can find them is if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, under recent sermons at the top, you'll find a link for Lesson 117 where you can get those notes. So again, there's three places where you can find them. You can go to gracelifebiblechurch.com under recent sermons, click on Lesson 117. If you're with me on YouTube right now, you can look at the top of the live chat, or you can look underneath in the comments. I have shared a comment that has a link there. So, in fact, I just posted that, so I actually forgot to click comment, so that should be there now. So you should have three options if you are looking to follow along using the notes. So I want to get right into things. Our study today is Lesson 117, the Coverdale Bible, Assessing the Contents of the First Complete English Bible. You know, one of the things as I was thinking about this that occurred to me is, you know, we're all very familiar with, Bible readers in the 21st century are very familiar with the Bible. We're very familiar with the way Bibles are set up, with the way Bibles are laid out, with the idea of there being marginal notes, with the idea of there being explanatory introductions at the beginning of books, a table of contents, possibly maps, a concordance, you know, all these kinds of things. As 21st century Bible readers, you know, we just sort of take these things for granted. And given the fact that Coverdale's Bible is the first complete Bible in English, I thought it would be important before we move on to really kind of look at what was in that Bible and how it kind of set the standard and the tone for what would follow in Bibles after that. Okay, so we're going to do that this morning by assessing the contents of the first complete English Bible. So if you're with me, you need to be on page one at the top under introduction, and this is where we're at. Thus far, we've done four studies on the Coverdale Bible. In doing so, we have sought to assess the following aspects of the project. So in Lesson 113, we looked at this impetus. What was it that motivated Coverdale to do this Bible, to translate this Bible? In Lesson 114, we looked at the source, the five sundry interpreters that Coverdale used to make his translation, and we tried to evaluate and analyze and assess some things about the source of it. Then in Lesson 115, we tried to look at and assess Coverdale's ability as a translator. And we looked at those portions of his Bible where he is translating independent of William Tyndale, because Tyndale hadn't done that yet. And so his work is original in the sense of it being the first translational work in English to show up in a printed edition. Of course, acknowledging that Wycliffe translated into Middle English in the late 1300s. And then our fourth lesson was Lesson 116, which was on assessing Coverdale as a reviser of Tyndale. So that's what we looked at last week, those places where Coverdale was revising Tyndale based upon looking at his five sundry translations. So since Coverdale's Bible is the first complete English Bible ever printed, prudence dictates that we spend time looking at its contents, since it set the standard for printed English Bibles moving forward. So I just mentioned again a moment ago that we are very used to a Bible having a lot of stuff in it other than just the inspired preserved text or those words that were given under inspiration. Bible editors, printers, publishers, and so forth have put a lot of stuff, ancillary material, into these Bibles, and that really started a long time ago. It's not necessarily a new development, and that's kind of what I want to look at here this morning. So the trend-setting nature of Coverdale's Bible, though, is most important when it comes to how he handled the Apocrypha. The majority of what we're going to talk about today in this lesson is going to be focused on how Coverdale handled the Apocrypha, and then how his handling of the Apocrypha set the standard for how Protestant translations would deal with the Apocrypha moving forward. So before we get into that, though, I have a few other things that I want to just show you. So before discussing the Apocrypha, I'd like to comment on the following aspects of the project. So we just kind of want to look at the organization of Coverdale's Bible, the layout of it, and some of the features that he included. Then we're going to look just shortly at marginal notes and the way Coverdale used marginal notes, how many marginal notes there were, what were some of the things that he was trying to convey by using marginal notes. And then after that, then we'll look at the Apocrypha, which will take the majority of our time. So at the bottom of page one, the first point, organization layout and features. Point one. The first complete Bible in English was a small folio in size. Now, when you hear that word folio, that's just talking about the size of the Bible. It's not a large Bible. It's nearly like a pocket-sized edition, maybe probably a little bigger than that, but it's not a huge, it's not large in terms of its physical size. There are 57 lines of text per page, and the typeface is comprised of angular black letters. So it's very sort of standard for early 16th century English printing, the way it appears as far as the size, the letters, the number of lines of text per page, and so forth. Okay, so bottom of page one. In terms of front material, we've already seen Coverdale's Bible contain the title page. That's number one. So I've showed you how in Antwerp it was originally printed with a title page that talked about German and Latin, and then in England that got reworked. The stuff about German and Latin was removed, and it just simply talked about being translated into English. So we've already looked at the title page. I'm not going to show you that again. Number two, we've also already looked at the dedication to Henry VIII. We've looked at that in a couple lessons prior, as well as I talked to you about the prologue, Miles Coverdale to the Christian Reader. So in the beginning of that Bible, you have a title page, you have the dedication to Henry VIII, you have the prologue, Miles Coverdale to the Christian Reader, and then you have the books of the Holy Bible, or what we might call in our day a table of contents page, right? So that's the page that tells you, you know, 2 Kings is on page, you know, 156 in a modern Bible, a table of contents page, or a books of the Bible page is what Coverdale called it, okay? So I have here the top page two. This is the top, the title banner of that, the books of the Holy Bible, both that are named in English and Latin. So that's the top of that page. And then if you look at page two on the notes, that's broke down into six parts. What he calls the books of the first part are Genesis to Deuteronomy. So that would be what we might call the Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Bible that are written by Moses. Those are the books of the first part, excuse me, according to Coverdale. Then he gets into what he calls the books of the second part, Joshua through Esther. Now, of course, if you're looking at the notes, I gave you the old spellings there as well as the modern spellings. Then the books of the third part, which are Job to Solomon's Ballads, or what we call today Song of Solomon in our modern Bibles. Then the fourth part he calls the prophets, which would be Isaiah to Malachi. Then you have the Apocrypha, Eterus to Maccabees, and then the New Testament. So it's broken down there into six parts, the way that Coverdale has that set up. So if you scroll your notes down to page two, you can see that I've given you also that. So at the top there, You can see the books of the Bible, and you can see there from these two pages that Coverdale has divided it into six parts that I just went through with you, and you can examine those in more detail there if you're looking at the notes on pages 2 and 3. So he's got the Bible, the whole Bible, including the Apocrypha, broken down into six parts, and that's the way that he has divided it, right? So go to page 5. Go to page 5 in the notes. Now, each one of these six parts had a dedicated title page. So it's broke down into, the whole Bible is broken down into those six parts we just covered, and then at the beginning of each part, there's a dedicated title page that's included. The following is an example of the books of the second part, i.e. Joshua to Esther, and the other five parts had a similar title page. So if you're on page 5, you can see that. I've zoomed in for you here for the benefit of the recording. So that's the second part of the books of the Old Testament, and you can see that starts with Joshua and it ends with Esther. So of all of those, for all of those six different parts that we just covered on the title page, there's embedded within the text a separate title sheet for each one of those parts. So the books of the first part, the books of the second part, the books of the third part, then there's one for the prophets, then there's one for the Apocrypha, and then there's one for the New Testament. So I didn't show you all of those here because I, for time and space purposes, but I want you to get sort of just the general overview, the flavor here of what's going on and how Coverdale has this thing organized and set forth for the English reader. Now, again, it's important to just to know that up until this point, what had the English Bible reading community had in terms of a printed edition? Well, they had the New Testament of Tyndale. They had Genesis through Deuteronomy of Tyndale. They had in his 1534 edition some of that, the readings of Salisbury, some of those Old Testament readings that fit into the liturgical calendar, but they did not have an entire Bible. So it seems to me, as I think about these things, that Coverdale is sort of really trying to introduce the reader here to the Bible, to the way the Bible's structured, to the way the Bible's organized, and thereby giving them the ability to interact with the Bible in a way that they can at least understand some basic things. A lot of the stuff that Coverdale is including might seem to be sort of basic or rudimentary to us today, but at the time, remember that these people had never seen a complete Bible in English. All they had seen is parts of it, sections of it, but never the whole thing together under one cover. So let's go to page 6. Another feature of Coverdale's Bible was the use of woodcut illustrations and drop caps to decorate the page and offer visual aids to the reader. The following example is taken from Genesis 1. Similar artwork and drop caps can be found throughout the work. So if you're on page 6 in the notes, you can see that. And here it is for you on the video. So you see six illustrations there. This is from Genesis chapter 1, illustrating these six different days of creation. And then you can see the ornate eye there, the drop cap for Genesis 1:1 in the beginning. So Coverdale's Bible is filled with these types of woodcut illustrations as well as drop caps to decorate the page and to offer visual understanding for his readers. Now, I'm going to say this here. I've said it before, but I'm going to mention it again. Remember that for the majority of the history of the dispensation of grace, especially in the English-speaking world, I'll even say in the Catholic-speaking world, to say it that way, across Western Catholic Europe, the majority of the population was illiterate, which is why when they did these stained glass windows in these Gothic churches and so forth, they put these scenes from the Bible to help people with, you know, understanding the stories because they could not read them. And there are a variety of reasons for that, obviously. One of them, they're illiterate. Number two, the Bible's not even available in the language of the people because it's in Latin, etc. But when Coverdale does his Bible, he includes a lot of these types of illustrations. So the pages are decorated. They've got illustrations. They've got things there to try to help the reader understand what they're reading in a visual way. If you go to the top of page 7, this is a woodcut from the end of Exodus. This is from Exodus 40 of the children of Israel camped around the tabernacle. So that's a woodcut that's in page in Exodus 40 in the Coverdale Bible. So again, these things are included to try to help the reader visualize and understand what they're reading. These types of illustrations are all through the Coverdale Bible. If you ever have a chance to look at a PDF copy, you can scroll through and it's interesting to just scroll through it and just look at the things that there are little illustrations, little woodcuts for, as far as helping the reader in that way. Bottom of page 7. Coverdale also included an introduction of each canonical book in which he provided a short written summary of every chapter or each chapter. The following is the example from the book of Genesis. So if you go to page 8, you'll see this. So this is at the beginning of Genesis. There is a one-sentence summary of every single chapter of the book of Genesis, every single chapter of the book of Genesis. There's a one sentence summary of that chapter here that Coverdale has provided, and then he does that then for every book throughout the whole Bible. So these are just some basic organizational formatting and layout things that are interesting. So when I pick up my Scofield Reference Bible here, and I go to, I don't know, let's just say Hosea. I'll just go to Hosea because that's what I open to. And there's this information here at the top of the page, background information and so forth about Hosea, the dates, some explanation of what the theme, the purpose, when it was written, all that kind of stuff. Now, that's a modern study Bible doing that. But the idea of the reader needing some assistance with understanding layout, formatting, and so forth happens very early on in the printing of the English Bible. So Coverdale is doing these kinds of things. He's got the table of contents. He's got it broken out. He's got an introduction at the beginning of each book. He's got illustrations, woodcuts, drop caps. He's got all of that to try to, you know, really help the reader understand what's going on. So that's the first point, just looking at organization stuff, layout stuff, some things that are interesting. Now, I'll say this. From there, this just is going to continue to sort of expand over time. The next Bible that we're going to look at, I have one on my shelf back over here. I should have grabbed it, but the Matthew's Bible from 1537 is going to just expand this even further. This idea of ancillaries, aids, pre-information, all of that. And then, of course, if you look at a modern study Bible, there's all kinds of stuff in a modern study Bible. I also have a book over here, a Bible over here from 1877 that has all sorts of these kinds of things in it, as I have an American printing over here from 1828 from a company in Massachusetts that's got a bunch of that kind of stuff in it, too. So Coverdale starts this. From there, it's just going to kind of expand. And we're familiar with this kind of thing from our understanding of modern Bibles. So let's go to page 9 and look at the second point, which is marginal notes. Regarding Coverdale's use of marginal notes, J.I. Mombert states the following in his English versions of the Bible from 1883. Please note that I have updated much of the spelling as possible. Some of this, I have no idea what the word is, so I didn't try. The rest of it, the majority of it, I was able to update. So he says, quote, Mombert says, quote, the very limited number of notes. So there's not a ton of footnotes. There's not a ton of marginal notes in Coverdale's Bible. There are 66 in all. So in the whole thing, there are 66 marginal notes or footnotes. 47 of them are in the Old Testament, and 19 of them are in the New Testament. So there's not a ton of notation here in Coverdale's Bible. So, of the notes in Coverdale's Bible indicates very plainly that they also are drawn from the versions which stand to his in relation of parent to child. So, what does that mean? That means this. We've looked at the five sundry interpreters that Coverdale used. The vast majority of the marginal notes that he has in his Bible, of these 66, the vast majority of them are him providing alternative readings from these other interpreters. So he'll give you what he says in English, and then he'll say in the margin, oh, Luther reads this way, or Zurich reads this way, or the Vulgate reads like this. That kind of stuff is what he has in the majority of these marginal notes. And again, they reinforce the concept that we've seen in an earlier lesson, that Coverdale's translation is secondary as well as eclectic. So we talked about that last week in our time together, right? So Coverdale's, you have first level, so you'd have the Greek here, Greek and Hebrew here, at the first level you'd have Luther, Zurich, you'd have Pagentius, you'd have first level translations of the Hebrew and Greek, and then underneath that you'd have Coverdale. So Coverdale's not using the Greek and Hebrew up here, he's using Luther and the five sundry interpreters at this level. So when we look at the marginal notes, the 66 marginal notes that are included in Coverdale's Bible, they make very plain the idea that Coverdale's translation is secondary and that it's eclectic. The way Mombert describes it here as parent to child. So in other words, Luther, the Zurich Bible, all those are the parent, and Coverdale's is the child. And so the notes sort of bear this out. Excuse me. They furnish both alternative readings and explanatory matters. So let's just look at a couple of these. We don't need to read all of them. I've given you all of them here as examples for you to consider, but let's just look at a couple. So let's look at the first one. Genesis 3:6. A pleasant tree to make wise. So that's what Coverdale had in the text. A pleasant tree to make wise. And then he has in the margin, some read, while it made wise, and then he's got Luther and Zurich. So he's telling you in the text what he had in English, and he's telling you in the margin that some others had this, while it made wise, and that's what Luther and Zurich had. So, again, you see there the secondary nature of what Coverdale's doing. Most of the marginal notes are of this kind of thing. Let's look at Genesis, this would be Genesis 17:2. I am the Almighty God. Luther, Pagentius, and the Vulgate. So some read, I am God, Shaddai. So, and then he's got what the Zurich Bible has there in German. So again, it's real clear when you look at this how Coverdale is conceiving of things. Go to drop down in that list. We're on page 9. Drop down in that list to Matthew chapter 1, verse 8. Matthew chapter 1, verse 8. So here we have an occurrence of Erasmus. Before they came together, Erasmus. Some read, before they sat at home together, Zurich. And then he mentions Luther, and then he mentions the second edition of Tyndall. So again, the marginal notes that he does include are most often, of these 66 notes, they're most often to explain the reading. If you look at the next one down from Matthew chapter 16, verse 7, a box of precious ointment, Tyndall, second edition, an alabaster box, some read, a glass of precious water, that's what Luther had. So the notes are trying to just explain the reading, trying to give you different insights into how the reading should be. So you can look at the rest of these here on page 9. And again, those are just samples of the other 66 notes, but the majority of them are this type of explanatory information. So let's go to the top of page 10. Before moving on to talk about the Apocrypha, it's important to note that Coverdale's marginal notes bear witness to the secondary and eclectic nature of his translation. I kind of said that already. From his marginal notes, we see how his five sundry interpreters impacted his English readings. In the marginal notes, we see the familiar names of Luther, Tyndall, the Vulgate, Pagentius, and Zurich, all of which are noted as sources in previous lessons. So all of those we've already looked at and noted as sources from previous lessons that are impacting it, and then we look at the marginal notes, And we see that the alternative readings are coming from these exact sources, and so that just reinforces what we've already said. That should not be a surprise. In fact, that's probably what we should expect to find if we've been accurate about what we've said in the other statements, and I believe that we have been. And there's also the one mention of Erasmus, at least in the samples that I gave you. So we see there that he's not really, none of these are really questioning the text and saying, well, it should read this or it should read that. They're just really saying, you know, here's how other people have translated. And that seems to be consistent with what we've understood about Coverdale and his methodology so far. So we got, we've covered now the two smaller points that I want to cover, and we're on page 10. And what I want to get into next is the Apocrypha and how Coverdale handled the Apocrypha. Now, before I get to the notes, I just want to say, when the King James Bible was translated in 1611, it had the Apocrypha in it. Critics of the King James Bible will say, well, the King James Bible can't be without error because it had the Apocrypha in it, and we all know the Apocrypha is not Scripture. And so these are the kinds and sorts of things that people have said, critics of the King James Bible. Well, what we really need to do is understand the history of the Apocrypha in the English Bible. Now, when we get to talking about the King James specifically, when we get to talking about the 1611 edition in particular, I'm going to share with you the thoughts not only of King James himself about the Apocrypha, but also the thoughts of the translators and their attitude towards what they were translating when they were working on the Apocrypha. What I want to cover this morning is the precedent for how the Apocrypha would be handled in the English Protestant Bible that was set by Coverdale as a lead up then to understand later on why the King James translators did what they did with the Apocrypha in the King James. So Coverdale's Bible appears in 1535, 1536. The King James is on the market in 1611, right? So you got about 80 years, give or take there, of translational history between Coverdale and King James that we need to try to understand. And that's what I want to cover here with this point, or at least try to cover. So, there's some fine print there. Please note that much of the material covered in this section was extracted from my 2012 booklet, The Apocrypha and the King James Bible. So when these notes go live, there's an embedded link here that you can click on. Well, actually, you can do that now already, in fact, if you want to read that whole booklet and look at what I said about it. So a lot of what I'm going to say here, minus the pictures and some of the images, I have expanded a few things here, are taken from that booklet. So let's look at point number one here under the Apocrypha. As we know, it was in 1535 that Miles Coverdale published the first complete English Bible. Coverdale's Bible set a precedent in one history-making matter related to the relationship between formatting and doctrine. Formatting meaning layout of the Bible, doctrine meaning, you know, what's the Bible teaching kind of thing. In versions predating Coverdale's, the apocryphal books were scattered throughout the Bible and included within the Old Testament, okay, included within the text of the Old Testament, thereby indicating that they possessed the same authority as the canonical Old Testament books. So before Coverdale, the apocryphal books were sprinkled throughout the whole Old Testament. They were not subdivided into a designated section, as we're going to see Coverdale did. So by sprinkling them through the Old Testament, the reader is left with the impression that all of these are inspired scripture. By segmenting them into a certain section and calling it Apocrypha, what Coverdale's doing is he is drawing the reader's attention in a very visual way, in a very graphic way, to the fact that these books are not necessarily viewed in the same esteem as these other canonical books. So let's finish this point. The Coverdale Bible was the first to locate the Apocrypha between the Old and the New Testaments. So if you picked up a King James, a 1611 King James Bible, you would find the Apocrypha in a separate section between the Old and the New Testaments. Coverdale is the first one to do that. He is the first one to extract the apocryphal books out of the Old Testament and subdivide them and segregate them into their own section in the Bible, in a printed English Bible. So, Coverdale indicated the secondary nature of the Apocrypha by utilizing two important visual cues. Number one, he set the apocryphal books apart in the table of contents from the rest of the Old Testament. So I want to go back to an image I showed you earlier, right? So if you look at this image here on this side, you can see that it says the Apocrypha and that those books are divided from the New Testament. I'm sorry, the New Testament down here and the rest of the Old Testament over here. So that's a formatting feature. They are subdivided on the table of contents page into a separate category. And again, the pictures of that are on pages 3 and 4 in the notes if you want to scroll back up and get a closer look at that. And second, he included a separate title page for the Apocrypha upon which he noted their secondary status and the fact that they were not recognized by the Hebrew people as canonical. So let's read that. And I've included also for you there the image of that. So I'm on page, let me get back to it here on my slideshow. I am on page 10 at the bottom. So on this image, you see a zoom in of the language that I'm about ready to read to you. And then you can see the whole page there of the apocryphal title page that appears at the beginning of this section. So here's what he said. He said, the books and treaties, which among the fathers of old are not reckoned to be of like authority with the other books of the Bible, neither are they found in the canon of the Hebrews. So that's, at the bottom of page 10, that's the statement that you're reading. That's what's pictured there in that picture at the bottom of page 10. That's what's pictured here in this slideshow. That's the statement. So the statement is very clear. It is indicating that they are secondary, that they're not of the same authority of the other books of the Bible, and that they cannot be found in the Hebrew Bible. So the Hebrews never viewed these books as canonical. The Jewish nation did not view the Apocrypha as canonical. They are added later because of church tradition and other things, okay? If you want to learn about that, you want to find the lessons in this series about canonization, where we went over the issue of the canon and how it was determined and settled and all that stuff in great detail. You'll want to find those lessons on canonicity. So scroll down to page 11 now. There you'll see the full image that I just showed you on the slideshow of the title page for the Apocrypha in Coverdale's Bible. So bottom of page 11. Coverdale was the first translator to set apart the apocryphal books as having a distinct place and a lesser value than the canonical books. His precedent established the standard format for Protestant English Bibles. So in my opinion, the most important thing that comes out of this first edition of Coverdale is how he chose to handle the Apocrypha, how he formatted it, how he set it up in the Bible. Now, eventually, the Apocrypha is going to fall out of, you know, use. If I go to the store now and buy a King James Bible, it's not going to have the Apocrypha in it, and it hasn't for some time. I'll comment on that here later on. So that's definitely the most important feature of Coverdale's Bible. Now, see, that's related to formatting and doctrine, like I said earlier. So on the title page, it's set aside. On the table of contents page, it's set aside into its own section. And then when I get to that section, I encounter this language here and a title page indicating that this was never accepted by the Hebrew people and it's of secondary status. So the formatting of it, the layout of it, indicates something about what Coverdale believes about the contents of it in relationship to the rest of the Old Testament. Still in the bottom of page 11. F.F. Bruce concurs with Donald Brake regarding when the apocryphal books were first placed between the testaments. Bruce writes, quote, Coverdale's Bible of 1535, following a Zurich Bible of 1524 through 1529, first separated the apocryphal books from the canonical books of the Old Testament and placed them after Malachi, with special introduction of their less authoritative character. I just read that to you. There was one exception. Baruch was still placed before Jeremiah. So there is that one exception. But in a 1537 edition of Coverdale, Baruch was removed from there and placed after Talbot. So, I don't know if you want to call that an error, a printer error, or what have you, but all of the apocryphal books in the original 1535 Coverdale Bible were in this apocryphal section except Baruch. When the 1537 revision of Coverdale came out, it was removed and placed in the Apocrypha under Tobit. So that's kind of what happened with Coverdale and why this is important and why we're talking about it here in this lesson. Page 12. The Matthew's Bible of 1537, which added the prayer of Manassas, as well as the Great Bible of 1539, followed Coverdale's lead in placing the apocryphal books between the testaments. So, all the Bibles following Coverdale, the Matthew's Bible, the Great Bible, and as we'll see in a second, the Geneva Bible, they all are placing the Apocrypha between the testaments, and thereby indicating through the format, through the setup, what they believe about those books in relation to the rest of the books of the Old Testament. The Geneva Bible of 1560 prefaced the apocryphal section, and once again between the testaments, with the strongest statement to date against the canonicity of the apocryphal books. So if you're on page 12, you'll find this image. This image I took from the Apocrypha title page in the Geneva Bible. And there's all that language there underneath this, and it says Apocrypha, the argument. So if you scroll down on your notes to the bullet point underneath that image, this is a modernized spelling of what is stated in that image. It says, these books that follow in order after the prophets unto the New Testament are called Apocrypha, that is, books which were not received by a community consent to be read and expounded publicly in the church, neither yet served to prove any point of Christian religion, save inasmuch that they had the consent of the other scriptures called canonical to confirm the same. So what they're saying there, what the Geneva translators are saying there, is that no one ever appealed to these books in isolation from other clear statements in the canonical books to prove any point of doctrine. So this is a very precise statement that the Geneva translators are using to clearly communicate to the reader that these books are not as authoritative as the rest of the Old Testament. Reading on, or rather, whereon they were grounded, but as books proceeding from goodly men were received to be read for the advancement and furtherance of the knowledge of the history. So they're saying these are history books. They're just like secular history books. They're just recording some history. That's what the Geneva translators are saying about the Apocrypha. For the instruction in goodly manners, godly manners, which books declare that at this time God had a special care of in his church and left them not utterly destitute of teachers and means to confirm them in the hope of the promised Messiah, and also witnesses to those calamities that God sent to his church were according to his providence, who had both so threatened by his prophets and brought it to praise for the destruction of their enemies and for the trial of his children. So basically what they're saying there is that the apocryphal books are history books, and that all they're doing is recording the history of, they call it the church. Theologically, I obviously don't think that's the church, the body of Christ, but just saying that the things that God said in the prophets, you know, the people of God faced, and that they're recorded in the apocryphal books. That's what the statement or the disclaimer here is saying in the Geneva Bible from 1560. But again, the format here is following what Coverdale did, as well as the inclusion of a statement indicating their secondary nature. Bottom of page 12. Moreover, the Geneva translators printed the Prayer of Manasses as an appendix to Second Chronicles, adding a notation of its apocryphal character. So if you go to the top of page 13, and this is a little bit distorted there in the image, I didn't even include this image in my slideshow, it says underneath the image, the prayer, this prayer is not in the Hebrew, but is translated out of the Greek. So again, steps to indicate that this is not part of the Hebrew text. So a lot of things going on here with the Apocrypha that are important to know. Next point. The Bishop's Bible of 1568 also separated these books from the rest of the Old Testament and included a separate title page. However, they included no apologetic reason for doing so. So what we just read here from the Geneva Bible is a whole paragraph defense, apologetic, of why they're doing this. The Bishop's Bible set them aside, still set them aside between the Testaments and included a separate title page, but didn't have any explanation of the reasoning or the rationale for why they were doing that. So this omission angered the Puritan party within the Church of England, which agreed with the Geneva tradition and was against the canonicity of the Apocrypha. So the bottom line is the Puritans, who supported the Geneva Bible, viewed the Bishop's Bible as weak because they offered no apologetic defense of why they were formatting the Bible the way they were. The first Bible to omit the Apocrypha were some copies of the Geneva Bible published at Geneva in 1599. Now, what's interesting about this is that there's a gap in the page numbering between the Testaments. So if you go to the end of the book of Malachi, let's just say it said, for the sake of illustration, page 499. And then if you went to the beginning of the New Testament, it said page 600. So it skipped 200 pages. So the numbering was just gone, right? So there's a gap in the page numbering between the Testaments indicating that the decision to omit the Apocrypha was made after the pages were printed, but prior to binding. So the apocryphal section was printed, but the binder, the publisher, decided not to include them in the binding because of the gap in the page numbers. So that happens for the first time in 1599. So by the early 17th century, when the translation work on the Authorized Version began, there was already historical precedent for including the Apocrypha in a separate section between the Testaments. Furthermore, Protestants had been using this device to put forth their beliefs that the apocryphal books were not inspired since the Coverdale Bible of 1535. So Coverdale's Bible is very important in how it set the standard for how the Apocrypha would be dealt with in English Protestant Bibles. Consequently, so I'm still on page 13, consequently, the King James translators were merely following the standard Protestant practice of the day as to how to handle the Apocrypha in the English Bible. These realities reflect the religious tension that was still present in the early 17th century. So when the King James translators do their work in the early 17th century, and they do it in the way, in the manner, in the process in which they did, where they put the Apocrypha between the Testaments, they are simply following what had been the precedent for nearly 80 years for how to handle this, and the one who set that precedent was Coverdale. So I'm still on that same point. These realities reflect the religious tension still present in the early 17th century. The Church of England, so that would be the Anglican Church, the bishops, retained the custom of reading from the Apocrypha in public worship services during certain seasons of the year. Now, of course, the Puritan faction rejected that. The Puritan faction was the faction that supported the Geneva Bible with a strong statement against the Apocrypha, whereas the Anglican Church, the bishops of the Anglican Church, didn't have that strong language. They still thought that the Apocrypha was useful and read from it in public worship during certain times of the year at the time that the King James Bible was published. Now, think about that. If the king's putting his authorization on the King James Bible, you're going to have the Apocrypha in the King James Bible because that was what was done at the time. And if the king is the head of the Anglican Church and the Anglican bishops think that the Apocrypha is still important to be read during, you know, public worship at certain times of the year, then lo and behold, you're going to have the Apocrypha in the King James Bible. But it's included in such a way so as to indicate, again, its secondary non-canonical status, non-inspired status. So the King James Bible came out in 1611. Look at the next point. In 1615, so about 4 years later, Archbishop Abbott, this would have been Bancroft's successor. Bancroft was the archbishop who, under King James, set up the rules for the King James translation. So Abbott is Bancroft's successor. Abbott forbade any printer from issuing a Bible without the Apocrypha on pain of 1 year's imprisonment. So here you have the Archbishop of Canterbury saying, if you print a Bible without the Apocrypha in it, we're going to sentence you to jail time for 1 year if you do that. So obviously no printer... is going to do that. They're going to include it. I mean, why would they subject themselves to that type of imprisonment and punishment at that time? So for the early history, the printed history of the King James text, at least, the Apocrypha is there. Now, let's look at the next point. An edition of the Geneva Bible published at Amsterdam in 1640 omitted the Apocrypha deliberately. So this is the first printed Bible that we know of to deliberately omit the Apocrypha. Now remember in 1599 there was this edition of the Geneva Bible that just skipped the Apocrypha and the page numbering, but this is a deliberate omission in 1640. It was not simply the binders doing this time. The defense of the omission was inserted between the testaments. So how do we know that this was intentional on the part of this Amsterdam publisher? We know that because this following, top of page 14, there's a statement, there's an apologetic statement inserted there where the Apocrypha should have started, according to all the precedent in English Bibles up to this point, and so they insert the following apologetic statement. Top page 14 quote, "The omission was in line with the prevailing tendency in England at this time, where in 1644 Parliament ordered that the canonical books only should be publicly read in church. This tendency was reversed after the Restoration." So there's a lot of politics going on there in England with the English Civil War and so forth that I don't have time to get into, but all of that's affecting the politics of the English Bible. So I'm just going to say it this way for now. I'll explain more of this later when we get to it. But sometimes King James advocates have this idea that when the King James Bible rolled off the press in 1611, that the entire English-speaking world was like, oh, finally, we've got God's Word in English. And they just immediately stopped using the Geneva Bible and stopped using the Bishop's Bible and stopped using any of the predecessors of the King James. That's not true. The King James Bible, especially during the English Civil War, when the Puritans took over the government under Oliver Cromwell, the King James Bible sort of fell out of favor a little bit there because of who's running the country. Who's running the country? It's the Puritans. It's the guys who didn't like the king. And so if they're running the country, their preferred Bible, the Geneva Bible, is going to be the Bible that is going to be, you know, the most highly promoted and so on and so forth. Well, eventually they lose and the monarchy is restored in the Restoration, and the King James Bible is going to have an ascendancy, but it did not immediately happen. And in fact, because it was authorized by the Crown during the period of the English Civil War, when Cromwell was running the country, it fell out of favor. Now, it was never persecuted and burned and so on and so forth, but it was not the it was not the version of choice or the popular version. So, finishing this quote, this tendency was reversed after the Restoration, but the exclusion of the Apocrypha became increasingly popular among the nonconformists. So that would be these Puritans under Cromwell that I just mentioned. It is noteworthy that the first English Bible printed in America in 1782-1783 lacked the Apocrypha. So eventually the Apocrypha just falls totally out of, amongst Protestant editions of the Bible, it just is eventually becomes just superfluous and completely left out. Now, it takes some time for that to happen, but Coverdale is the one who set the trend on how it should be handled, and it was like that all the way through until the decision was made to just take it out, and it didn't need to be there. So, top page 14. It was Coverdale's Bible from 1535 that set the precedent for this later history in terms of how the Apocrypha was handled in Protestant editions of the Bible. So, I hope that makes sense to you. I am going to go back here and just check the live stream, see if there were any comments or questions. A lot of hellos and greetings and this sort of thing. I'm not necessarily seeing any questions there. But Coverdale, the real thing that we need to take away from this first edition, this first printed edition, is how the Apocrypha was handled. And that's really the key. And the point I was just making, I'm going to elaborate and show you the documentation, but the King James Bible, after it was printed during that period of English Civil War, really was secondary, at least under the Puritan reign, to the Geneva Bible. So the politics of the English Bible and the popularity of a given Bible was really at first, in the first, say, 50, 60 years after the King James was printed, was really a matter of the politics of the Crown and who was running the country and so on and so forth. Eventually, the Apocrypha becomes viewed as superfluous. It falls out of printing. People stop using it. And so Protestant editions then drop it and no longer include it. Now, you can obviously go to and still buy a Catholic Bible. And if you buy a Catholic Bible to this day, you'll still find the Apocrypha in it. And you'll find the Apocrypha not in a segregated section, but you'll find it all through the whole Old Testament. And so we need to acknowledge, at least in this case, that Coverdale's influence as far as formatting and doctrine when it comes to the Apocrypha is quite significant and important in the history of the English Bible. So that brings me to the end of what I want to cover in relationship to Coverdale. We've talked about the impetus of Coverdale's Bible. We've talked about the source. We've looked at him as a translator. We've looked at him as a reviser. And now we've looked at his first edition and how it influenced Bible organization, printing, formatting, and layout, especially in relationship to the Apocrypha, and how that set the trend then for all these other English Bibles that would come later, including the King James. So next Sunday, assuming I have sufficient time to finish a lesson, which I'm a little bit hesitant on whether I will, because I also have to finish the church survey of the saints for how to restart church, which I'm prioritizing this week as more important than a Sunday school lesson. But if I get a Sunday school lesson done for next week, we will be looking at the Matthew's Bible, which is the next Bible that followed Coverdale. And there's some things we want to note about that as we continue to look through these things. So I hope that you're finding this stuff interesting. I hope it's not boring. I hope it's not like, you know, when are you going to end this kind of stuff. I hope that you are definitely digging into really trying to get a handle on what was going on here, the history of it, and how we later on are sort of the recipients of these things from a, in a historical sense. So, with that said, I'm going to end the lesson and sign off. We'll be back around 10:30 with the main Sunday morning message, which is going to be continuing our study in the book of Colossians. This morning we're going to be looking at Colossians chapter 1, verse 19, and the doctrine of fullness, and what that is, and how that should impact us and our thinking as believers. So, thanks for tuning in for the Sunday school class. I'll be back on. See you in about a half an hour. Thanks for your time.